Hello everyone. I'd like to welcome you all to this seminar in the series on anti-Semitism now. I'm David Feldman. I'm the director of the Birkbeck Institute for the Study of Anti-Semitism. And it's a huge pleasure and an honor to introduce our speaker today, Sergio Della Pergola from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Sergio is Professor Emeritus there and the former chairman of the university's Harman Research Institute of Contemporary Jewry. He's a specialist in the demography of world Jewry. He's published numerous books and monographs. He was a member of the steering committee and indeed played a formative role in the two FRA services on perceptions of discrimination and anti-Semitism in the EU carried out in 2012 and 2018. He is the winner of the Michael Landau Prize for Demography and Migration and of the Marshall Sklar Award for Distinguished Achievement given by the Association for the Social Scientific Study of Jewry. So it is really with great expectation that we have him here today to speak on Jewish perceptions of anti-Semitism, reflections on contemporary European data. Sergio.
Thank you very much, David. Good afternoon. It's a great pleasure to be your guest today and to present a few data and a few thoughts mostly related to the Fundamental Rights Agency study of perceptions of discrimination and anti-Semitism. The FRA, as you all know, is a branch of the European Union. Let me just say a couple of words about myself and my interest with anti-Semitism. I, as mentioned, come from demography and the social sciences. My interest in anti-Semitism has been, of course, part of my life as anyone who grew up after World War II and heard the tales of my parents who were safely hosted by Switzerland, escaping from Italy under very tragic circumstances. But more recently, in 2010, I was appointed a member of the Yad Vashem Committee on the Writers of the Nations, and this has given me access to very interesting materials and an occasion to reflect on history, although again, I'm no historian. And then more recently, I was appointed in the steering committee, in the advisory committee of the first FRA study in 2012, and then the second FRA study in 2018. And so I've had an occasion to participate in scholarly debates, in meeting colleagues, and in having a more direct opportunity to be exposed to materials and to think about the major issues. So it is coming relatively late and with enormous respect for the huge amount of literature and scholarly investment that has been put into this that I meet you today. And as mentioned, I will present some reflection and perhaps a different mode of looking at the data of the 2012 and 2018 surveys as a basis for expanding the discussion. One of the terms of reference in the discussion recently has been also the debate about definitions of anti-Semitism, the IRA, the JDA, and other attempts. And I will also address that at some point in my presentation. So I will get to the PowerPoint, which I hope you can see on your screen. And I will start with a couple of preliminary observations. In fact, one wonders why is anti-Semitism relevant and so much debated in our days? And I thought that, in fact, sometimes it's not clear. I mean, of course, it is disturbing, but in rough generalization, anti-Semitism may be perceived as an outlook, a set of actions, maybe a coherent project aimed at achieving a goal, but what those goals might be. So the first goal is physical violence and annihilation of the Jews. Now, this has been done in history, and of course, we have to remember, by the way, I signal to those who haven't heard about it, that the Israeli TV these days has broadcasted an incredibly interesting document, and it is the direct recordings of Adolf Eichmann done in Buenos Aires, Argentina in the 1950s that were concealed in a German archive during the last years. And so you hear from the real voice of Eichmann what he did, why he did it, what he thought he was doing. And it is an incredible and amazing document. It is a full confession, a conscious confession of the plan and of what he did, contradicting totally, by the way, his testimony at the trial in Jerusalem in the early 1960s. It is something you should not miss. So, of course, this is something that has happened. Iran and some others speak of annihilating the state of Israel, but it's not what really happens in daily life to our generation. The second point is marginalization and exclusion of Jew from civil, social, economic and cultural life, which is also something that has happened often in history. But again, today, I would say that most of the Jews worldwide live in countries that are democracies or fairly democratic regimes. There is a legal structure that prevents such forms of exclusion from society. And Jews are granted in most places all of the liberties and equality they deserve. And so this is not a real phenomenon. In fact, I do not deal with this in my work with the FRA, but the FRA study has materials about actual feelings of exclusion and discrimination. And you find that the percentages today are extremely low, really very, very marginal. The third thing, which perhaps we don't think enough about is the worsening of the Jews' private quality of life by arousing fear, frustration, and anxiety. That is, this is a personal element which does not have so much public salience, but certainly at the individual level is very relevant. And this brings me to another point, which I think we have not debated enough in the literature. And it is that the human perception, as we know, can be divided in different perceptional domains. One of them is the cognitive, where you express your ideas and your opinions about a certain phenomenon or action. There is the experiential, that is your actual experiences having met a certain situation. And then there is the affective emotional, which deals with your emotions and what you feel under a certain circumstance. And I think the literature is full of knowledge and data and analysis regarding the cognitive and the experiential, but very little we know about the affective emotional. In other words, does anti-Semitism create with you greater fear, or maybe greater self-assuredness, maybe greater loneliness, or maybe greater connection with the community, or other sentiments which are not completely rational, but they are part of your daily life. And you speak about that, you feel that, and that's very important in your daily life. So this is a point that we shall mention again later. Another point is my very strong idiosyncrasy regarding the very use of the term anti-Semitism. Recalling that anti-Semitism in the 19th century was initially intended as hostile and offensive. It is a fake euphemism. It is not a neutral kind of objective term. It is something intended to offend, to point to something bad and inferior. And there has been, in my view, a misunderstanding and misuse of anti-Semitism, which in my view goes parallel to the persisting use of race in the social scientific literature, especially in the United States. As you may know, the United States is one of four or five countries in the world that still uses race in its official statistics. All of the other countries have abolished it or use a different term. Now, racism is a serious issue, but races do not exist. Likewise, anti-Semitism is a serious issue, but Semitism is something that does not exist. And so anti-Semitism is clearly about the Jews. When we speak of the other part of the so-called Semites or the Arabs, we speak of Islamophobia. So it's very strange to continue using anti-Semitism. Jews should have the right to be clearly designated and not latently concealed and cowardly dispossessed even of the right to be insulted. I think the word anti-Semitism is a sort of camouflage. And I also think that using a disqualified term to address a serious issue in a sense adds a pinch of complicity and does a disservice to both scholarship and to civil society. Having said that, I use anti-Semitism like anyone else, and so we can go ahead. Now, a word about my data. The FRA did two surveys on large representative samples of Jews in cross sections of countries which are members in the European Union. In 2012, 5,600 Jews participated voluntarily, and in 2018, the number was 16,000 and more. In reality, in 2018, we had more countries. And so when we compare the countries where the survey was done twice, we find that still there was a significant increase from less than 6,000 in 2012 to more than 13,000 participants in 2018, which means probably two things. One, the better capability of the organizers to penetrate the market and to reach in different ways the relevant public through the internet, through links that had been distributed through different ways. And also another reason is probably the greater interest among the public vis-a-vis the feature, that is a greater concern regarding the various aspects of anti-Semitism. In fact, we know that in 2012, more than 75% of the respondents indicated that anti-Semitism in their perception had increased over the last 5 years. And in 2018, more than 85% of the respondents said the same. Anti-Semitism is perceived to have increased during the last 5 years. So true or false, this is not the point of giving credibility to those percentages, but unquestionably there is a high rate of dissatisfaction and fear. And this may have caused greater numbers of people to participate. It is a very large sample. It is fairly representative in the sense that we could check the socio-demographic profile of the respondents in the internet survey with other sources of data we had from censuses and other surveys. And we could find that at least on some fundamentals like sex, age, geography within countries, the proportions were fairly stable and fairly corresponding to what we know about the total population. And a very important point is that this is not a sample of the affiliated Jewish population only, but there is a very fair proportion of unaffiliated who got the message and the link through other people and through other channels. And therefore, even if probably not a very perfect representative sample, it covers all possible areas of inclusion in the Jewish community. And we have proof of that looking at other data that I do not represent here in detail. That is the frequency of beliefs, of participation, and of the mode of presentation of self that covers really the widest possible range of possibilities. Now, I move to a presentation of some data. And the first thing I want to demonstrate is a descriptive table taken from the 2012-2018 FRA survey giving the percentage of selected issues that are considered societal issues as problems in the perception of Jews. We have 12 countries participating, and you see the names of the countries in the upper line. And we have the various issues. At the end, we find that the two issues which are the most preoccupying are anti-Semitism and racism, followed by crime level, unemployment, immigration, intolerance toward Muslims, and government corruption. These were the variables included in this particular question. We have marked those variables that are more frequent in each country. And in fact, there are some country variations, but anti-Semitism and racism generally appear among the three strongest nearly everywhere, although there are some countries with other types of concerns, like unemployment in Italy or intolerance towards Muslims in Denmark and government corruption in Spain and Hungary. Now, what you see here is a descriptive table which provides interesting material, but we can improve over that by using a method called similarity structure analysis, which takes the data, calculates the covariation between the various parts, and represents those covariations as distances on a map. So giving an answer to the question, what is more central and shared by all, and what is more peripheral that is of interest to this part, but not to that part of the population investigated. And here we see that in fact, anti-Semitism and racism are at the center of the perception of European Jews, whereas other types of concern are sort of the specialized province of people who live in one country or in another country. I would only note an interesting feature that Muslim discrimination is not associated with immigration in the perception of Jews. And it means that Jews can understand there is an independent factor at work which operates against Muslims, although Muslims are also perceived, later on we'll see it, as possible perpetrators of anti-Semitism. We can now repeat the same procedure with the main perceptions of the contents of anti-Semitism as it was investigated in the FRA survey. And we find that there are basically three areas of interest, Jewish-related, Holocaust-related, and Israel-related. But here we have investigated the same issues at two different levels. The cognitive, that is what you think of this, do you think this is anti-Semitic? And the experiential, have you heard this statement explicitly made by a non-Jewish person? And what we learn is also an important fact that should be kept in mind all the time. The cognitive is much higher than the experiential. There is much higher percentages of people who think a certain thing is anti-Semitic and than those who have actually had the experience in their life. The ranking, by the way, several questions were asked in both modes. And we find that the ranking is similar. Perhaps the thing that gets the highest percentage of all is related to exaggeration of the Holocaust, but also thinking that Jews are foreigners or have too much power. These are also, or exploit Holocaust victimhood for their own purposes is very disturbing. And this is what we find. Interestingly, when we look at the Israel-related answers, we find that criticizing Israel on very specific grounds calls for very high percentages of people who think it is anti-Semitic, although criticizing Israel in general does not. There is a big distinction between just having something to say about Israel and specific aspects of really denying the Israeli state. So we move to the similarity structure elaboration of the same data, and we find something which is of interest. The cognitive and the experiential are clearly separated. That is, if you look at this map as a cross-section of the brains of 16,000 Jews in Europe, you find that they can distinguish very clearly between the two patterns of perception. However, we can also see that those patterns are organized typologically, as we perhaps had expected, between Jewish-related, that is anti-Jewish thoughts, Holocaust-related, kind of negationism, and Israel-related. Incidentally, from right to left, you also have a chronology of history: Jews, then the Holocaust, and then the Israel. This is the sequence by which things happen. So we learned that there is a cognitive map that is very coherent. There are a number of inconsistencies here and there, but it's very strong. And so we can say at this preliminary stage that Jews perceive anti-Semitism as one cluster composed of three negationism axes: as an individual, as a potential victim and survivor of planned extermination, and as a member of a national collective. These three things are related in a way which is very difficult to disentangle, contrary to those who would have, for example, the distinction between old anti-Semitism and new anti-Semitism. I'm not saying that perceptions are absolutely rational, but this is what we have: the three elements that do overlap and do interact the one with the other, although they are clearly distinguished. Another way of showing the interaction between the various elements is this: looking at a map of the topics valued as essential in one's own Jewish identity. And here we find that, of course, there are different possibilities in terms of defining your Jewish identity. This is again an SSA map. It does not refer to percentages, but to the logical correlation, actually covariation between the different components. And what we discover is that the sense of concern for Israel and the sense of Jewish peoplehood are very strictly related. And interestingly, they moved between 2012 and 2018 much more to the center of the perceptional map, meaning there is a greater consensus among respondents that those are important and they are central in their perception. Let's now look at a more stratified perception of the anti-Semitism patterns, beginning with the channels of diffusion. So we find that there are different channels. It can be in the street, it can be through the socials, which are so important these days, in a stadium, but it can be at political assembly, it can be by the profanation of a cemetery, it can be through cultural events or the educated media, the proposition to boycott Israel or academy. In these maps, I remind, the closer the points, the more associated they are. The more distant mean that different people are involved in them and people do perceive them as unrelated to some point, although they all form part of the basic cluster. And at the center, we have the web, that is an instrument of diffusion which can serve the different purposes of the different publics that, for example, go to a stadium or go to the university or to a cultural event, different people, but the web can serve all of them. If we now superimpose the main contents of the perceived offense, we find that otherness, that is the anti-Jewish basic sense, and the Holocaust are more connected with those forms which are in the street, in the socials, perhaps more popular forms. Physical violence is, of course, related to cemeteries and graffiti, and anti-Israel elements are more perceived as associated with the higher culture of academy, cultural event, and the more serious printed or electronic media, with the web serving all purposes at the same time. We now superimpose a further stratum of perceptions, and it refers to the perceived perpetrators. And here we see that 16,000 European Jews perceive the right, to some extent, the Christian extremists, more associated with Holocaust denial and with anti-Jewishness. We find that Islamic persons are associated with physical violence in the perception of Jews, and left political movements and individuals are associated with anti-Israel positions, and they are more present in academy and culture. So that if we sort of try to synthesize these different strata of perceptions, we find that perhaps we can give labels to each of these areas. As you see, the total perceptional space is quite clearly partitioned in several areas, which kind of conceptually are more homogeneous and different from the other areas. So we can give them labels. I would suggest, for example, in the bottom part, the concept of practical anti-Semitism, having in mind perhaps the idea of a practical joke, where there is something physical along with the idea. Then you have the political sector, where political parties, political leaders, in part in connection with the subject matter, but also in part in connection with struggles that have their inherent logic in the political system, get together. The populist area is the one which is somewhat more spontaneous, perhaps less elaborated, simpler, and more conventional and traditional in its contents. And then what I would call the narrative approach, that is something more intelligently elaborated, something that is obviously associated with a more educated constituency and the loci of their presence in society. So in fact, by summing up these findings, we can say that practical anti-Semitism is mostly concentrated in physical action and aggression in the state or other public places, vandalism of Jewish buildings and institutions, desecration of Jewish cemeteries. The political anti-Semitism, which is manifested in public life at political events, speeches, discussions, also reflecting party interests and leadership struggles. A populist anti-Semitism, spontaneous and defamatory expressions on the internet, excluding the social media, mural, including the social media, mural graffiti in a social situation, in the public space at sports events. And the narrative anti-Semitism, which is found through thoughtful and research items in the printed and electronic press, at cultural events, and in academia. These are the perceptions of European Jews, and at the center of all perceptions, the web and its omnipresent influence, to the point that sometimes we tend to confuse the medium with the content. We say that anti-Semitism is the web. But no, in fact, the web is just an instrument, and we should not actually confuse the total with the part. But of course, it is instrumental in its diffusion. Now, just one word about the attempt to define anti-Semitism. I have collected here five examples of definitions by the IRA, by the Jerusalem Van Leer, by the Anti-Defamation League, in a big survey conducted in more than 100 countries in 2014, and the two FRA surveys, noting that the reference group is different. The first two are elite panels who deliberate about what anti-Semitism is. The ADL was run on the total population of those countries, and the FRA was run in the Jewish population. And in addition, IRA and JDA refer to behavioral variables, the ADL to cognitive variables, and the FRA refers to both modes. By looking at the way the variable anti-Semitism was subdivided internally, we find that there was attention to Jews, to Holocaust, and to Israel, but in different proportions. For example, both the IRA and the JDA focus very strongly on Israel, the ADL on Jewish power, and to some extent also the FRA is strongly focused on Jewish foreigners' diversity. There is, however, one interesting exception, and it is the JDA in 2021, who also proposed examples of what is not anti-Semitism. And all of the examples were related to Israel. And here they are. In fact, the guidelines the JDA gave to non-anti-Semites, say supporting Palestinian demand for justice and human rights, which is shared by many people, although admittedly not by all, criticizing or opposing Zionism as a form of nationalism. This is something that can be debated. Criticizing Israel as a state, including its institutions and founding principles. Now, this founding principle is rated anti-Semitic by 88% of European Jews. So as you see here, we have a contrast between one very serious attempt to define anti-Semitism and what the population actually feels. And likewise, boycott, divestment, and sanction apply to Israel is rated anti-Semitic by 82% of European Jews, which is quite different, as I mentioned, from just criticizing Israel, which is much lower. And finally, criticism of Israel that some may see as excessive or contentious or reflecting a double standard. Well, here we do not have statistics, but I think that the concept of double standard is very problematic and would be rejected by most. And so this is to say that sometimes the scholarly attempt to devise a serious definition of anti-Semitism runs counter the public opinion. And so in conclusion, I come to my conclusions and say that contrary to the deductive approach of most definitional efforts, I would suggest to study perceptions and experiences of anti-Semitism following an inductive approach, that is turning the analysis of anti-Semitism from top down to bottom up. That is, the voice and the perspective of the object and victims of such hostility has been minimized or even ignored, and instead it should be heard in the first place before any broader theoretical elaboration and definition is put forward. Maybe not exclusively, but certainly it has to be given a strong stake. What remains fundamental, in my view, but has received insufficient attention in the debate, is the different strategies of anti-Semitic offense as perceived by the offended public, reflecting the overlap of contents, diffusion channels, and perpetrators. I have suggested a fourfold typology of practical, political, populist, and narrative anti-Semitism, which might be useful operationally in the continuing definitional effort and in the continuing fight against anti-Semitism. In other words, rather than going ahead with long lists of possible occurrences, I think a better conceptualization is needed, and I've suggested one. Also, keeping in mind what I have repeatedly asserted here, the difference between the perception of what is cognitive, what is experiential, and what importantly is also the emotional affective aspect of contemporary anti-Semitism. And with these suggestions, I think I will stop here, and I thank you for your patient listening. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sergio, for such an extensive and a rich and in some respects a challenging lecture. We have half an hour for questions and discussion. If you do have a question, please raise your hand and I'll call on you to ask you to unmute yourselves. I see that Ephraim has a question. Ephraim, please go.
Yes.
Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. I wanted to say, in my own experience, one should also consider what is the percentage of the general Jewish population that has experience of a given environment. For example, if you see now how they perceive academia, it is because they send their children to university. And so they cannot imagine what is happening to academics. In my experience, it has been totally life-changing. The other Jew at that workplace of 200 staff already committed suicide in 1996. And a researcher came running into the room and shouted to a colleague, did you hear about that Polak Fag who is dead? And this is not something that to which I would say the general Jewish population would be receptive, because they don't belong in the offices of academia. They know about academia because this is where they either sent or are sending or will send their children to study. Perhaps there should be some model that would take into account how some environment have exposure to the general Jewish population. And then we can see that there's very much variation also about Jewish academics and how they experience academia. Because of course, not every department will have the anti-Semite and who is one who can't take decisions. When they can't take decisions is when they become really dangerous.
Thank you, Ephraim. Would you like to answer that, Sergio?
I can, if I got Ephraim right. I'm not sure I've got 100%, but I should reiterate what my data are and what where they come from. This is a general cross-section of Jewish population of adults, more than 16,000 in 12 countries. So they are represent their understanding, their perceptions. Some of them are academics, by the way. The proportion of educated people in the Jewish population is fairly high. So many adult Jews do have personal contact with one or another type of cultural event. Certainly many people read the London Times or the New York Times, well, the Le Monde, Corriere della Sera, that is, they read and they look at TV programs and they participate in cultural events. I mean, this is based on a broad perception. Some have had a direct contact and some don't. As I stressed all along my presentation, the proportion of those who find actual anti-Semitism in experiences they have lived is significantly lower than the proportion of those who perceive it theoretically as a concept. By the way, I would give a high degree of maturity to the Jewish people for being able to make those distinctions, likewise across different types of concepts that I have outlined in my presentation. Nonetheless, what is interesting here is that there are certain associations between certain types of contents and certain types of social situations. And this cannot be neglected. I mean, you know, in certainly in my country, but probably everywhere, there is this tendency sometimes to say, all the world is against us. That is, you have a certain sense of undistinguished, unstructured reaction to something which is negative. I think our task as scholars is to provide structure, is to find the latent element, whereas it is not so evident. And by doing what we have done with the technical procedures and also the categories that we have set, I think we do a useful job in advancing a more sensitive understanding of the general topic of anti-Semitism. And therefore, we do discover that in terms of the perceptions, and those perceptions may also be totally wrong, but we shall not culpabilize thousands of people if they have made a mistake, but these are the perceptions. They tend to associate certain topics with certain channels of distribution with certain perpetrators. And this is what remains in their hearts and minds. And they, of course, will lament or will act accordingly in the rest of their daily life.
Thank you, Sergio. Brendan, you have a question.
Yes, thanks very much, Sergio. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Great. Yeah, I really enjoyed that. And I find your suggestion that we begin our understandings and interpretations of anti-Semitism with the perceptions and experiences of Jews themselves to be a very important contribution and a provocation, if you like, actually, because so much of the debate, as you well know, and as you outlined, actually, towards the end of the presentation, so much of the debate is focused on definitions. But in recognizing the significance of that point of yours, I actually did want to ask a question about definitions. You briefly had a slide towards the end of some commonalities between, say, for example, the IHRA and the JDA and other approaches and some distinctions. And then there was one slide, I think, immediately after that, where you detailed four or five examples of political action which are not classified as anti-Semitism under the JDA. And one of those is boycotts, for example. And this is a kind of minor detail, but I did want to ask a question about that, because my reading of the JDA is actually rather different. My reading of the JDA is that boycotts are not in and of themselves anti-Semitic, but that they can be given the context. And I think there's somewhere in the JDA, perhaps in the preamble, I think there's somewhere that says, you know, these are not closed cut cases. Context is always important. So when I read the JDA, I think, well, boycotts could well indeed be anti-Semitic, but it depends on the context and the language and possibly intention that is used. So I wanted to just ask you whether you read the definition differently or whether you read it.
Thank you, Brendan. Very interesting point. But this, I think, is the key of the question. And in a discussion I had with a colleague, the bottom line was this. The colleague said, we, the scholars, we know what is anti-Semitism. You present data what the Jews think is anti-Semitism. So the question is, who's going to run the game? We, the knowledgeable people, or them, the people down at the lower level? Are we those who have the knowledge in a better position to judge than those who are actually experiencing the feature? So returning to your words, the GDA says, we think, and scholarship thinks, and part of the literature believes that this action is not anti-Semitic. This is our position. Now we go to the field, and we discovered that 82% of the people think differently. And so let's confront that those who know, the scholars, and I am one of them, have certain tools and certain models and certain historical perceptions and good theories and good reasons for believing something. But I think we cannot ignore what the people perceive. At the end of the day, anti-Semitism is against the people. It is not against the scholars. And they will be the ones who will make the judgment. I will not say that the only way to decide what anti-Semitism is to ask the people, because this becomes also a form of populism. But I say you cannot ignore what the perceptions of thousands. In fact, those 16,000 represent more than 1 million European Jews. And that's fundamental to understand. And then perhaps we should correct some of our theory and our proposition, taking into account that something that we thought honestly would not be offensive is considered offensive by the people.
If I could just follow up on Brendan's question, Sergio, it seems to me that what you have set out is absolutely clear, that the proponents of the JDA face a very considerable political challenge in persuading Jewish people in Europe that that definition is a proper defense against anti-Semitism. And I see there's a great value there in what you've said, but I wonder what status, I'd like to push you a bit on what status you give to what ordinary everyday Jewish people think anti-Semitism means. Because certainly in this country, I imagine across most of Europe, the preferred definition of anti-Semitism of most Jewish people is the IHRA working definition. And yet there are some features of that definition which also Palestinians living in Europe would say are themselves racist, or I mean certainly deny their experience. So you have two sets of experiences which clash with each other. And so how can one, so it seems to me that there's a limit to what status one can give in adjudicating in this situation.
Well, of course, the dilemma is that this is not intended to be, I mean, it can be intended to be pure scholarship, or it can be intended to reflect perception by real people. And so, of course, the example of Palestinians and the IHRA is interesting, but it is not really what matters here. It is the Jews. Now, you can like the Jews or dislike the Jews, and I can be with you, but the problem is that we don't have alternative Jews. This is what we have, and this is what we have to cope with. What though I would say as a sort of critique to what I was presenting before is that, I mean, there are certain definitions which reflect a certain theoretical perception by groups of scholars. And but this is true also of the FRA and also of the ADL. And I can testify, I am myself one in a panel of scholars who defined anti-Semitism for the FRA. So we had to, in any case, you have to present a kind of conceptual framework, and you have to articulate that framework by considering, first of all, the great variability of contents that has characterized historically anti-Semitism. For one, well, we all know that there is a big disagreement among scholars whether anti-Semitism should be taken in the broadest historical sequence from the early origins of humankind to date, or just to start in the 19th century as a kind of turning point. I honestly will concede that I'm in favor of the longer term historical vision and the accumulation of different concepts under greatly variable intellectual, cultural, socio-political circumstances. But one of my preferred quotes comes from Cicero, the famous Roman politician and rhetorician. And what he said in the year 59 before the Christian era could be a quote from one of the dailies today, word by word. It is simply amazing. Now, of course, we have to understand that the political and the cultural context, which is totally different. And we cannot simply say Cicero was an anti-Semite. This is not the case. But we have to understand that there is a continuity in certain specific concepts, words, terms of reference. The trope has evolved, including so many turning points and incorporating so many new circumstances that did not exist previously. And so it has become enriched all the time. And so a good effort should be to take into account as much as possible of this. I don't think the IHRA did it. Certainly the JDA did not do it. We at FRA did it, but we also missed some interesting parts of the trope. I will give you one example. The day side has not been the Jews as day sides, people who killed God. This has not been included in some of the recent research investigations, whereas it was such a crucial point if you go back a few centuries. And certainly there are people who still believe that, and it would be interesting to understand how many do at this point. So what I'm saying is that in any case, you need a conceptual effort. And in my view, that effort must be comprehensive, and it has to take into account a variety of elements. It is a mistake to over-focus on one of the elements, as some did, because there is too much Israel in some of those definitions. And by the way, by saying that to say such and such is not anti-Semitic about Israel misses the point that you might also be not anti-Semitic by saying such and such about the Jews or about the Holocaust. Let me give an example. If I say that during the World War II, 15,000 Jews died of typhus, and that's all. To me, this is an anti-Semitic statement. If I say that 5 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust, I don't think this is anti-Semitic. I believe it is closer to 6 million, but if someone says 5, it may be incompetent, but it's not anti-Semitic. I'll give you another example, if you wish to smile with me. One says 28% of the Nobel Prizes were Jewish. Well, it's not true, because the true percentage is 22%. And so 28% is incompetent. But if they say 98% of the Nobel Prizes are Jewish because the judges are Jewish, well, this is a different statement. And so what I'm maintaining here is that there is a graduality of negativeness in these various statements. It is not white and black or zero and one. It is gradual, and so you have to accommodate that graduality in a good perception of the phenomenon. So there is a lot of work ahead for those who wish to devote time to improve the definition and make it comprehensive and balanced.
Thank you, Sergio. I mean, I for a very interesting answer. I mean, I think that it's particularly interesting that you say that one could go on and create a better definition, because another way of taking what you have just said, a lot of which I agree with completely, is that it shows how very limited any definition can be, because a definition immediately pushes one to think about black and white. And as you said at the end of your comments, then there are gradations. We have a couple of questions in the chat. Let me move to them. Kate Turner asks, thank you for a really fascinating presentation. She has two questions. Did your research determine how much time respondents spent on social media? She would imagine a strong correlation between time spent on social media and personal experience of anti-Semitism. And secondly, was the 2018 study undertaken before or after the Tree of Life synagogue shooting? And if it was, do you think responses would have differed had the study been conducted after?
Sorry, remind me what's exactly the event and when?
The Tree of Life is the shooting in Pittsburgh, synagogue in Pittsburgh, in October 2018.
In that case, I have the answer. The 2018 was long concluded before Pittsburgh. It was done basically between something like May and June 2018. So it has nothing to do with Pittsburgh. In terms of the first question, it's a very interesting question. Unfortunately, I do not have a real answer in terms of how much time people devote to the social media. And that's, of course, a factor that may be highly influential in their perception. I would say that the more you are exposed, then the more you perceive it. I personally am not on Facebook, and so I do not have that opportunity, nor on Twitter, nor on Instagram. I'm an exponent of a very old generation. It is also true that sometimes we forget that what really counts is the multiplier between a certain tweet or a certain reporting and the number of people who actually get it. And I will give you one example, which is a curiosity, but maybe relevant. I once at random became exposed with a horrible site, horrible. And I went into it, I explored it, horrible. It was unbelievable, extremely stupid among us, but in any case, very offensive, mostly devoted to Shoah. But then there was also an indicator of how many people had already accessed that particular site. And I discovered I was number three. So on one hand, you can say this is unconscionable and it must have a huge influence. But then you have to give a proper weight to those things. On the other hand, unquestionably, today, the exposure of people to information is enormously greater than it was in the past. And therefore, another point of caution is that the perceptions of increasing anti-Semitism that I have reported at the beginning of this talk are definitely not necessarily a manifestation of the increase of actual events, but actual events multiplied by their reporting through the various channels, which have become increasingly more efficient and more penetrating. And so, again, this is a word of caution about the general dynamics of the phenomenon, which perhaps we tend to exaggerate in function of this specific process.
Thank you, Sergio. We have a couple more questions in the chat. One from Lynn Joffe asks, please, can you tell us the quotation from Cicero? And secondly, and before you do, the other question we have is that it's an interesting point to suggest that anti-Semitism is an inaccurate definitional term. What would be a more accurate definitional term, in your view?
Well, it's difficult because, I mean, there is a discussion, Judeophobia, I would prefer, but those who are technically expert with phobias say it is not technically accurate. Anti-Judaism, the word Judaism can be also interpreted more as an idea than as the actual people. Incidentally, we have in Jerusalem an Institute of Contemporary Jewry. Jewry are the people. Judaism is the complex of the concepts and institutions. It's complicated. In theory, the word should be anti-Jewism, but this is a term which I don't think will become very popular. So operationally, we can go on with anti-Semitism, but let us be aware, and I will also smiling say this, if Wilhelm Marr and those who preceded him, because he was not the first, had said anti-bastardism, I'm not sure in academia we would be speak of anti-bastardism or anti-pigism. You know, it's the kind of blurred concept of the Semites which has become popular. Now, going to Cicero, I can send everybody concerned the full quotation because it is not really on my desk at the moment. But he says basically this, look at that rumorous crowd. Look at the power they have. Look at the lobby. Look at how they send gold to Jerusalem. We have stopped this for the sake of the state and for the sake of the Senate. Now, the ludicrous judgment about the Jewish crowd and the Jewish lobby is something that you can really find today nearly everywhere. And it is amazing how the Romans were pagans. It has nothing to do with Christianity. It is a big mistake to attribute the beginning of anti-Semitism to Christianity, because certain concepts existed long, long, long before, as we know, and as we also know from a certain reading of biblical sources. Of course, they are reported by Jews, but they are interesting nonetheless. And then the gradual introduction of new concepts, like the concept of the nation, or the concept of race, and then the concept of social class. And then, of course, the concept of the independence of the state of Israel. And to complete the series, the concept of COVID, which recently was also a matter of developing new forms of anti-Jewish discourse. This is to say that there are different innovative junctures in history, and at each of them, there is a way to implement something which is negative against this interestingly long-term people.
Thank you, Sergio. We have just one last question in the chat from Michael Salzberg. We'll have to end after this, but Michael, thanks you for the excellent talk. He's interested in what other social research is done at present about the experience of anti-Semitism. Of course, that's a huge question about the field, which it would take a long time to answer, but it might be possible for you to say something, not least about whether there are plans to carry out a further FRA survey.
Yes, in the primary, it is planned, it is already decided by the European Union to have a third FRA in probably beginning of 2023 by now. They have to prepare the instrument. There is one change, though. The FRA operated through a big international surveys firm called Ipsos Mori, and there Ipsos Mori worked then through JPR in London. As many of you know, JPR is an excellent facility devoted to Jewish policy research, and as far as I'm informed, the new tender was won by someone else. I cannot unveil the name of the firm. And so it is entirely not clear whether JPR will be involved this time or not. I am associated in a way with JPR. So I'm not sure exactly who will do it and whether it will be done with the same methods that JPR very carefully developed over the years in terms of continuity and comparisons. So this is one aspect. Of course, there is the European Union itself is conducting sometimes polls about anti-Semitism perceptions among the European population, but it does not go down to the detail that these more peculiar surveys did. So there is in general one question such as, are you concerned with the level of anti-Semitism in your country? This is a question that the Eurobarometer, for example, has asked. And it provides an interesting indicator because I've been able to demonstrate that there is a reverse correlation between concern about anti-Semitism in a country and the actual level of anti-Semitism in that country. In other words, if you are concerned, it means that you don't like anti-Semitism. If you like anti-Semitism, you are not concerned. And so you have to understand the mechanisms, the mental mechanisms of those perceptions. So having said so, I think there is quite a lot of room for continuing to improve the concept and monitoring. What I can say for sure is that in the United States, which in theory we might think anti-Semitism is less diffused than in Europe, the perceptions among Jews are very high, which again shows a certain gap that exists between Jewish perceptions and what we might call an objective assessment of the situation. However, when you compare the ranking of different countries based on this indicator and on the other indicator, that is the Jewish perception and some kind of objective measure of the diffusion among society, again, the levels are different, but the ranking of the countries is very similar. And so fact is that there are certain countries where the perception is higher and also the diffusion is higher than other countries. This is, of course, for those who are interested in policy resolutions, a very important point. And then let me perhaps conclude by saying this. There has to be said a word in favor of what the European Union has tried to do in having those surveys. Second, in giving very much attention to the findings and producing European reports, which I rate highly sensitive to Jewish sensitivities. That is, the European Union starts understanding the Jews in terms of their own sensitivities, and this is very important. And third, there is an action which now tries to combine fight against anti-Semitism and what they call enhancing Jewish life in Europe. That is, finding ways to make Jewish life more possible and more agreeable, which means that, in my view, there is a sincere concern within the European Union about the negatives of the findings that we have and about the need to improve the atmosphere and to make the Jews probably a more participating and comfortable part of the European project.
Thank you. Thank you, Sergio. We're out of time, unfortunately. I'd like to thank everyone who has come along to this seminar today, especially those who have contributed with questions in the chat or delivering them yourselves. But above all, I'd like to thank you, Sergio, for a talk and answers as well, which have been both empirically hugely rich, but also conceptually challenging. And we are all greatly in your debt. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.